"Gentlemen," he said, "I make this proposal out of faith, and I make it in the names of those we represent. I ask for time. I propose that we forego all votes regarding the future of the city until a proper royal delegation has been allowed to meet with the army outside and determine what, if any, opportunity there is for negotiations." He lowered his sheet, looking up, waiting for comments. "So," said Phylon, one of the merchants on the assembly, "you're asking us to give you the power to decide the city's fate." Phylon wore his rich suit so well that an observer would never have known that he'd first put one on about a year ago. "What?" Elland asked. "I said nothing of the sort. I'm simply asking for more time. To meet with Straff." "He's rejected all of our earlier messages," said another assemblyman. "What makes you think he'll listen now?" "We are approaching this wrong," said one of the noble representatives. "We should be resolving to beg Straff Venture not to attack, not resolving to meet with him and chat. We need to establish quickly that we're willing to work with him. You've all seen that army. He's planning to destroy us."
"Please," Elland said, raising a hand. "Let us stay on topic."
One of the other assemblymen, one of the Ska, spoke up as if he hadn't heard Elland.
"You say that because you're noble," he said,
pointing at the noble Elland had interrupted.
"It's easy for you to talk about working with Straff since you've got very little to lose."
"Very little to lose?" the nobleman said. "I and all of my house could be executed for supporting Elland against his father."
"Bah," said one of the merchants. "This is all pointless. We should have hired mercenaries months ago, as I'd suggested."
"And where would we have gotten the funds for that?"
asked Lord Penrod, senior of the noble assemblymen.
"Taxes," the merchant said with a wave of his hand. "Gentlemen," Elland said, then louder, "gentlemen."
This garnered him some small measure of attention.
"We have to make a decision," Elland said. "Stay focused, if you please. What of my proposal?"
"It's pointless," said Phylon the merchant. "Why should we wait? Let's just invite Straff into the city and be done. He's going to take it anyway."
Vin sat back as the men began to argue again. The problem was, the merchant Phylon, as little as she liked him, had a point. Fighting was looking like a very unattractive option. Straff had such a large army. Would stalling really do that much good?
"Look, see,"
Elland said, trying to get their attention again and only partially succeeding.
"Straff is my father. Maybe I could talk to him. Get him to listen. Luthadel was his home for years. Perhaps I can convince him not to attack it."
"Wait," said one of the Ska representatives. "What of the food issue? Have you seen what the merchants are charging for grain? Before we worry about that army, we should be talking about bringing prices down."
"Always blaming us for your problems," one of the merchant assemblymen said, pointing.
And the squabbling began again. Elland slumped just slightly behind the lectern. Vin shook her head, feeling sorry for Elland, as the discussion degenerated. This was what often happened at assembly meetings. It seemed to her that they simply didn't give Elland the respect he deserved. Perhaps that was his own fault, for elevating them to his near equals. Finally, the discussion wound down and Elland got out a piece of paper, obviously planning to record the vote on his proposal. He did not look optimistic.
"All right," Elland said, "let's vote. Please remember, giving me time will not play our hand. It will simply give me a chance to try and make my father reconsider his desire to take our city away from us."
"Elland, lad," said Lord Penrod, "we all lived here during the Lord Ruler's reign. We all know what kind of man your father is. If he wants this city, he is going to take it. All we can decide, then, is how best to give up. Perhaps we can find a way for the people to retain some freedom under his rule."
The group sat quietly, and for the first time nobody brought up a new squabble. A few of them turned toward Penrod, who sat with a calm, in-control expression. Vin knew little of the man. He was one of the more powerful noblemen who had remained in the city after the collapse, and he was politically conservative. However, she had never heard him speak derogatively of the Ska, which was probably why he was so popular with the people.
"I speak bluntly," Penrod said, "for it is the truth. We are not in a position to bargain."
"I agree with Penrod," Phylon said, jumping in. "If Elend wants to meet with Straff Venture, then I guess that's his right. As I understand it, kingship grants him authority to negotiate with foreign monarchs. However, we don't have to promise not to give Straff the city."
"Master Phylon," Lord Penrod said, "I think you misjudged my intent. I said that giving up the city was inevitable, but that we should try to gain as much from it as possible. That means at least meeting with Straff to assess his disposition. Voting to give him the city now would be to play our hand too soon."
Elend looked up, looking hopeful for the first time since the discussion had first degenerated.
"So you support my proposal?" he asked.
"It is an awkward way to achieve the pause I think necessary," Penrod said. "But, seeing as how the army is already here, then I doubt we have time for anything else. So yes, Your Majesty, I support your proposal."
Several other members of the Assembly nodded as Penrod spoke, as if giving the proposal consideration for the first time. "That Penrod has too much power," Vin thought, eyes narrowing as she regarded the elderly statesman. "They listen to him more than they do Elend."
"Should we vote, then?"
one of the other Assemblymen asked. And they did. Elend recorded votes as they moved down the line of Assemblymen. The 8 noblemen, 7 plus Elend, voted for the proposal, giving Penrod's opinion a great deal of weight. The 8 Ska were mostly for it, and the merchants mostly against it. In the end, however, Elend got the 2/3 vote he needed.
"Proposal accepted," Elend said,
making the final tally, looking a bit surprised.
"The Assembly divests itself of the right to surrender the city until after the King has met with Straff Venture in official parley."
Vin sat back in her seat, trying to decide what she thought of the vote. It was good that Elend had gotten his way, but the manner in which he'd achieved it bothered her. Elend finally relinquished the lectern, sitting and letting a disgruntled Phylon take the lead. The merchant read a proposal calling for a vote to turn control of city food stockpiles over to the merchants. However, this time Elend himself led the dissent, and the arguing began again. Vin watched with interest. Did Elend even realize how much like the others he acted while he was arguing against their proposals? Elend and a few of the Ska Assemblymen managed to filibuster long enough that the lunch break arrived with no vote cast. The people in the audience stood, stretching, and Ham turned toward her.
"Good meeting, eh?"
Vin just shrugged. Ham chuckled.
"We really have to do something about your ambivalence toward civic duty, kid."
"I already overthrew one government," Vin said. "I figure that takes care of my civic duty for a while."
Ham smiled, though he kept a wary eye on the crowd, as did Vin. Now, with everyone moving about, would be the perfect time for an attempt on Ellen's life. One person in particular caught her attention, and she frowned.
"Be back in a few seconds," she said to Ham, rising.
"You did the right thing, Lord Penrod," Elend said, standing beside the older nobleman, whispering quietly as break proceeded. "We need more time. You know what my father will do to this city if he takes it."
Lord Penrod shook his head.
"I didn't do this for you, son. I did it because I wanted to make certain that fool Phylon didn't hand the city over before the nobility extracted promises from your father about our rights to title."
"Now see," Elend said, holding up a finger, "there has to be another way. The survivor would never have given this city away without a fight."
Penrod frowned, and Elend paused, quietly cursing himself. The old lord was a traditionalist. Quoting the survivor at him would have little positive effect. Many of the noblemen felt threatened by Kelsier's influence with the Ska.
Just think about it, Elend said, glancing to the side as Vin approached. She waved him away from the assemblyman seats, and he excused himself. He crossed the stage, joining her.
What is it?
He asked quietly.
Woman at the back, Vin said quietly, eyes suspicious. Tall one. In the blue.
The woman in question wasn't hard to find. She wore a bright blue blouse and colorful red skirt. She was middle-aged, of lean build, and had her waist-length hair pulled back in a braid. She waited patiently as people moved about the room.
What about her? Elend asked.
Terrace, Vin said.
Elend paused.
You're sure?
Vin nodded.
Those colors? That much jewelry? She's a Terrace woman for sure.
So?
So I've never met her, Vin said. And she was watching you just now.
People watch me, Vin, Elend noted. I am the king, after all. Besides, why should you have met her?
All of the other Terrace people have come to meet me right after they enter the city, Vin said. I killed the Lord Ruler. They see me as the one that freed their homeland. But I don't recognize her. She hasn't ever come to thank me.
Elend rolled his eyes, grabbing Vin by the shoulders and turning her away from the woman.
Vin, I feel it's my gentlemanly duty to tell you something.
Vin frowned.
What?
You're gorgeous.
Vin paused.
What does that have to do with anything?
Absolutely nothing, Elend said with a smile.
I'm just trying to distract you.
Slowly, Vin relaxed, smiling slightly.
I don't know if anyone's ever told you this, Vin, Elend noted, but you can be a bit paranoid at times.
She raised an eyebrow.
Oh?
I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. Now, I happen to find it rather charming, but do you honestly think that a Terrace woman would try to kill me?
Probably not, Vin admitted. But old habits.
Elend smiled. Then he glanced back at the assemblymen, most of whom were speaking quietly in groups. They didn't mix. Noblemen spoke with noblemen, merchants with merchants, ska workers with other ska workers. They seemed so fragmented, so obstinate. The simplest proposals sometimes met with arguments that could take hours.
They need to give me more time, he thought.
Yet even as he thought, he realized the problem.
More time for what?
Penrod and Phylon had accurately attacked his proposal. The truth was, the entire city was in over its head. Nobody really knew what to do about a superior invading force, least of all Elend. He just knew that they couldn't give up. Not yet. There had to be a way to fight. Vin was still looking to the side, out over the audience. Elend followed her gaze.
Still watching that Terrace woman?
Vin shook her head.
Something else. Something odd. Is that one of Club's messengers?
Elend paused, turning. Indeed, several soldiers were working their way through the crowd, approaching the stage. At the back of the room, people had begun whispering and shuffling, and some were already moving quickly out of the chamber. Elend felt Vin stiffen in anxiety, and fear stabbed him.
We're too late. The army is attacked.
One of the soldiers finally reached the stage, and Elend rushed over.
What? He asked. Has Straff attacked?
The soldier frowned, looking concerned.
No, my lord.
Elend sighed slightly.
What then?
My lord, it's a second army.
It just arrived outside the city.
Oddly, it was Elendi's simple ingenuousness that first led me to befriend him. I employed him as an assistant during his first months in the Grand City.
11. For the second time in 2 days, Elend stood atop the Luthadel city wall, studying an army that had come to invade his kingdom. Elend squinted against the red afternoon sunlight, but he was no tin eye. He couldn't make out details about the new arrival. "Any chance they're here to help us?" Elland asked hopefully, looking toward Clubs, who stood beside him. Clubs just scowled.
"They fly Set's banner. Remember him? Guy who sent 8 Allomancer assassins to kill you 2 days back?"
Elland shivered in the chill autumn weather, glancing back out over the Second Army. It was making camp a good distance from Straff's army, close to the Luth-Davin Canal, which ran out the west side of the River Chanarel. Vin stood at Ellen's side, though Ham was off organizing things among the city guard. Orsir, wearing the wolfhound's body, sat patiently on the wall walk beneath Vin.
"How did we miss their approach?" Elland asked.
"Straff," Club said. "This Set came in from the same direction, and our scouts were focused on him. Straff probably knew about this other army a few days ago, but we had virtually no chance of seeing them."
Elland nodded. "Straff is setting up a perimeter of soldiers watching the enemy army," Vin said. "I doubt they're friendly to each other." She stood atop one of the sawtooth parapet crenels, feet positioned dangerously close to the wall's edge.
"Maybe they'll attack each other," Elland said hopefully.
Clubs snorted.
"I doubt it. They're too evenly matched, though Straff might be a little stronger. I doubt Set would take the chance by attacking him."
"Why come, then?" Elland asked. Clubs shrugged.
"Maybe he hoped he'd beat Venture to Luthadel and get to take it first."
He spoke of the event, the capture of Luthadel, as if it were a given. Ellen's stomach twisted as he leaned against the battlement, looking out through Merlin. Vin and the others were thieves and Ska Allomancers, outcasts who had been hunted for most of their lives. Perhaps they were accustomed to dealing with this pressure, this fear, but Elland was not. How did they live with the lack of control, the sense of inevitability? Elland felt powerless. What could he do? Flee and leave the city to fend for itself? That, of course, was not an option. But confronted with not one but 2 armies preparing to destroy his city and take his throne, Elland found it hard to keep his hands steady as he gripped the rough stone of the battlement.
Kelsier would have found a way out of this, he thought.
There! Vin's voice interrupted Elland's thoughts. What's that?
Elland turned. Vin was squinting, looking toward Set's army, using tin to see things that were invisible to Ellen's mundane eyes.
Someone's leaving the army, Vin said. Riding on horseback.
Messenger? Clubs asked.
Maybe, Vin said. He's riding pretty fast.
She began to run from one stone tooth to the next, moving along the wall. Her Chondra immediately followed, padding quietly across the wall beneath her. Elland glanced at Clubs, who shrugged, and they began to follow. They caught up with Vin, standing on the wall near one of the towers, watching the oncoming rider. Or at least Elland assumed that was what she watched. He still couldn't see what she had.
Allomancy, Elland thought, shaking his head. Why couldn't he have at least ended up with 1 power? Even one of the weaker ones, like copper or iron.
Vin cursed suddenly, standing up straight.
Elland, that's Breeze.
What? Elland said.
Are you sure? Yes. He's being chased. Archers on horseback.
Clubs cursed, waving to a messenger.
Send riders. Cut off his pursuit.
The messenger dashed away. Vin, however, shook her head.
They won't make it in time, she said, almost to herself. The archers will catch him, or at least shoot him. Even I couldn't get there fast enough, not running. But maybe...
Elland frowned, looking up at her.
Vin, that's way too far to jump, even for you.
Vin glanced at him, smiled, then leaped off the wall. Vin readied the 14th medal, Duralumin. She had a reserve, but she didn't burn it. Not yet.
I hope this works, she thought, seeking an appropriate anchor.
The tower behind her had a reinforced iron bulwark on the top. That would work. She pulled on the bulwark, yanking herself up to the top of the tower. She immediately jumped again, pushing herself up and out, angling into the air away from the wall. She extinguished all of her metals except for steel and pewter. Then, still pushing against the bulwark, she burned Duralumin. A sudden force smashed against her. It was so powerful she was certain that only an equally powerful flash of pewter held her body together. She blasted away from the keep, hurtling through the sky as if tossed by some giant, invisible god. The air rushed by so quickly that it roared, and the pressure of sudden acceleration made it difficult to think. She floundered, trying to regain control. She had, fortunately, picked her trajectory well. She was shooting right toward Breeze and his pursuers. Whatever Breeze had done, it had been enough to make someone extremely angry, for there were a full 2 dozen men charging after him, arrows knocked. Vin fell, her steel and pewter completely burned away in that single Duralumin-fueled flash of power. She grabbed a metal vial off her belt, downing its contents. However, as she tossed the vial away, she suddenly felt an odd sense of vertigo. She wasn't accustomed to jumping during the day. It was strange to see the ground coming at her, strange not to have a mist cloak flapping behind her, strange not to have the mist. The lead rider lowered his bow, taking sight at Breeze. Neither appeared to have noticed Vin, swooping down like a bird of prey above. Well, not exactly swooping. Plummeting. Suddenly snapped back to the moment, Vin burned pewter and threw a coin toward the quickly approaching ground. She pushed against the coin, using it to slow her momentum and to nudge her to the side. She hit right between Breeze and the archers, landing with a jarring crash, throwing up dust and dirt. The archer released his arrow. Even as Vin rebounded, dirt spraying around her, she reached out and pushed herself back into the air straight at the arrow. Then she pushed against it. The arrowhead ripped backward, throwing out shards of wood as it split its own shaft in midair, then smacked directly into the forehead of the archer who had released it. The man toppled from his mount. Vin landed from her rebound. She reached out, pushing against the horseshoes of the two beasts behind the leader, causing the animals to stumble. The push threw Vin backward into the air, and cries of equine pain sounded amid the crash of bodies hitting the ground. Vin continued to push, flying along the road just a few feet above the ground, quickly catching up with Breeze. The portly man turned in shock, obviously stunned to find Vin hanging in the air beside his galloping horse, her clothing flapping in the wind of her passage. She winked at him, then reached out and pulled against the armor of another rider. She immediately lurched in the air. Her body protested the sudden shift in momentum, but she ignored the twist of pain. The man she pulled against managed to stay in his saddle, until Vin smashed into him feet first, throwing him backward. She landed on the black earth, the rider tumbling to the ground beside her. A short distance away, the remaining riders finally reined in their mounts, coming to an abrupt stop a few feet away. Kelsier probably would have attacked. There were a lot of them, true, but they were wearing armor and their horses were shod. Vin, however, was not Kelsier. She had delayed the riders long enough for Breeze to get away. That was enough. Vin reached out and pushed against one of the soldiers, throwing herself backward, leaving the riders to gather their wounded. The soldiers, however, promptly pulled out stone-tipped arrows and knocked their bows. Vin hissed in frustration as the group took sight. "Well, friends," she thought, "I suggest that you hang on tightly." She pushed slightly against them all, then burned Duralumin. The sudden crash of force was expected. The wrench in her chest, the massive flare in her stomach, the howling wind. What she didn't expect was the effect she'd have on her anchors. The blast of power scattered men and horses, throwing them into the air like leaves in the wind. "I'm going to have to be very careful with this," Vin thought, gritting her teeth and spinning herself in the air. Her steel and pewter were gone again, and she was forced to down her last metal vial. She'd have to start carrying more of those. She hit the ground running, pewter keeping her from tripping despite her terrific speed. She slowed just slightly, letting the mounted Breeze catch up to her, then increased her pace to keep up with him. She dashed like a sprinter, letting Pewter's strength and balance keep her upright as she paced the tiring horse. The beast eyed her as they ran, seeming to display a hint of animal frustration to see a human matching it. They reached the city a few moments later. Breeze reined in as the doors to Iron Gate began to open, but rather than wait, Vin simply threw down a coin and pushed, letting her forward momentum carry her toward the walls. As the gates swung open, she pushed against their studs, and this second push sent her sailing straight up. She just barely crested the battlements, passing between a pair of startled soldiers, before dropping over the other side. She landed in the courtyard, steadying herself with one hand against the cool stones as Breeze entered through the gate. Vin stood. Breeze patted his forehead with a handkerchief as he trotted his animal up beside her. He'd let his hair grow longer since she'd last seen him, and he kept it slicked back, its lower edges tickling his collar. It wasn't graying yet, though he was in his mid-40s. He wore no hat, it had probably blown free, but he had on one of his rich suits and silken vests. They were powdered with black ash from his hurried ride.
"Ah, Vin, my dear," Breeze said, breathing almost as deeply as his horse. "I must say, that was a timely arrival on your part. Impressively flamboyant as well. I do hate to force a rescue, but, well, if one is necessary, then it might as well happen with style."
Vin smiled as he climbed down from the horse, proving he was hardly the most adroit man in the square, and stable hands arrived to care for the beast. Breeze wiped his brow again as Elland, Clubs, and Orsir scrambled down the steps to the courtyard. One of the aides must have finally found Ham, for he ran up through the courtyard.
"Breeze," Elland said, approaching and clasping arms with the shorter man.
"Your Majesty," Breeze said. "You are in good health and good humor, I assume?"
"Health, yes," Elland said. "Humor? Well, there is an army crouching just outside my city."
"Two armies, actually," Clubs grumbled as he hobbled up.
Breeze folded up his handkerchief.
"Ah, and dear Master Cladent, optimistic as always, I see."
Clubs snorted. To the side, Orsir padded up to sit next to Vin.
"And Hammond,"
Breeze said, eyeing Ham, who was smiling broadly.
"I'd almost managed to delude myself into forgetting that you would be here when I returned."
"Admit it," Ham said. "You're glad to see me."
"See you, perhaps. Hear you, never. I had grown quite fond of my time spent away from your perpetual pseudo-philosophical pratterings."
Ham just smiled a little broader.
"I'm glad to see you, Breeze," Elland said. "But your timing could have been a little better. I was hoping that you would be able to stop some of these armies from marching on us."
"Stop them?" Breeze asked. "Now why would I want to do that, my dear man? I did, after all, just spend 3 months working to get set to march his army down here."
Elland paused, and Vin frowned to herself, standing just outside the group. Breeze looked rather pleased with himself, though that was admittedly rather common for him.
"So Lord Set's on our side?" Elland asked hopefully. "Of course not," Breeze said. "He's here to ravage the city and steal your presumed atium supply."
"You," Vin said. "You're the one who's been spreading the rumors about the Lord Ruler's atium stash, aren't you?"
"Of course," Breeze said, eyeing Spook as the boy finally arrived at the gates.
Elland frowned.
"But why?" "Look outside your walls, my dear man," Breeze said. "I knew that your father was going to march on Luthadel eventually. Even my powers of persuasion wouldn't have been enough to dissuade him. So I began spreading rumors in the Western Dominance, then made myself one of Lord Set's advisers."
Clubs grunted.
"Good plan. Crazy, but good."
"Crazy?" Breeze said. "My mental stability is no issue here, Clubs. The move was not crazy, but brilliant."
Elland looked confused.
"Not to insult your brilliance, Breeze, but how exactly is bringing a hostile army to our city a good idea?"
It's basic negotiating strategy, my good man, Breeze explained as a packman handed him his dueling cane taken off the horse.
Breeze used it to gesture westward toward Lord Set's army.
When there are only two participants in a negotiation, one is generally stronger than the other. That makes things very difficult for the weaker party, which in this case would have been us.
Yes, Elend said, but with three armies we're still the weakest.
Ah, Breeze said, holding up the cane. But those other two parties are fairly even in strength. Straff is likely stronger, but Set has a very large force. If either of those warlords risks attacking Luthadel, his army will suffer losses, enough losses that he won't be able to defend himself from the third army. To attack us is to expose oneself.
And that makes this a standoff, Club said.
Exactly, Breeze said. Trust me, Elend, my boy. In this case, two large enemy armies are far better than a single large enemy army. In a three-way negotiation, the weakest party actually has the most power, because his allegiance, added to either of the other two, will choose the eventual winner.
Elend frowned.
Breeze, we don't want to give our allegiance to either of these men.
I realize that, Breeze said. However, our opponents do not. By bringing a second army in, I've given us time to think. Both warlords thought they could get here first. Now that they've arrived at the same time, they'll have to reevaluate. I'm guessing we'll end up in an extended siege, a couple of months at least.
That doesn't explain how we're going to get rid of them, Ellen said. Breeze shrugged.
I got them here. You get to decide what to do with them. And I'll tell you, it was no easy task to make Set arrive on time. He was due to come in a full 5 days before Venture. Fortunately, a certain malady spread through camp a few days ago. Apparently, someone poisoned the main water supply and gave the entire camp diarrhea.
Spook, standing behind Clubs, snickered.
Yes, Breeze said, eyeing the boy. I thought you might appreciate that. You still an unintelligible nuisance, boy.
Wasing aware of not, Spook said,
smiling and slipping back into his eastern street slang. Breeze snorted.
You still make more sense than Hammond half the time, he mumbled, turning to Elend. So isn't anyone going to send for a carriage to drive me back to the palace? I've been soothing you ungrateful lot for the better part of 5 minutes, looking as tired and pathetic as I can, and not one of you has had the good graces to pity me.
You must be losing your touch, Vin said with a smile.
Breeze was a soother, an allomancer who could burn brass to calm another person's emotions. A very skilled soother, and Vin knew of none more skilled than Breeze, could dampen all of a person's emotions but a single one, effectively making them feel exactly as he wanted.
Actually, Elend said, turning and looking back up at the wall, I was hoping we could go back up on the wall and study the armies some more. If you spent some time with Lord Set's force, then you could probably tell us a lot about it.
I can. I will. I am not going to climb those steps. Can't you see how tired I am, man?
Ham snorted, clapping Breeze on the shoulder and throwing up a puff of dust.
How can you be tired? Your poor horse did all the running.
It was emotionally exhausting, Hammond, Breeze said, wrapping the larger man's hand with his cane. My departure was somewhat disagreeable.
What happened anyway? Vin asked. Did Set find out you were a spy?
Breeze looked embarrassed.
Let's just say that Lord Set and I had a falling out.
Caught you in bed with his daughter, eh?
Ham said, earning a chuckle from the group. Breeze was anything but a ladies' man. Despite his ability to play with emotions, he had expressed no interest in romance for as long as Vin had known him. Doxson had once noted that Breeze was just too focused on himself to consider such things. Breeze simply rolled his eyes at Ham's comment.
Honestly, Hammond, I think your jokes are getting worse as you age. One too many hits on the head while sparring, I suspect.
Ham smiled, and Elland sent for a couple of carriages. While they waited, Breeze launched into a narrative of his travels. Vin glanced down at Orsure. She still hadn't found a good opportunity to tell the rest of the crew about the body change. Perhaps now that Breeze was back, Elland would hold a conference with his inner circle. That would be a good time. She had to be quiet about it, since she wanted the palace staff to think she'd sent Orsure away. Breeze continued his story, and Vin looked back at him, smiling. Not only was Breeze a natural orator, but he had a very subtle touch with allomancy. She could barely feel his fingers on her emotions. Once she had found his intrusions offensive, but she was growing to understand that touching people's emotions was simply part of who Breeze was. Just as a beautiful woman demanded attention by virtue of her face and figure, Breeze drew it by near unconscious use of his powers. Of course, that didn't make him any less a scoundrel. Getting others to do as he wished was one of Breeze's main occupations. Vin just no longer resented him for using allomancy to do it. The carriage finally approached, and Breeze sighed in relief. As the vehicle pulled up, he eyed Vin, then nodded toward Orsure.
"What's that?"
"A dog," Vin said.
"Ah, blunt as ever, I see," Breeze said. "And why is it that you now have a dog?"
"I gave it to her," Elland said. "She wanted one, so I bought it for her."
"And you chose a wolfhound?" Ham asked, amused.
"You've fought with her before, Ham," Elland said, laughing. "What would you have given her? A poodle?"
Ham chuckled.
"No, I guess not. It fits, actually. Though it's almost as big as she is," Clubs added, regarding her with a squinty-eyed look.
Vin reached down, resting her hand on Orsure's head. Clubs did have a point. She'd chosen a big animal, even for a wolfhound. He stood over 3 feet tall at the shoulder, and Vin knew from experience how heavy that body was.
"Remarkably well-behaved for a wolfhound," Ham said, nodding. "You chose well, El."
"Regardless," Breeze said, "can we please return to the palace? Armies and wolfhounds are all well and good, but I believe supper is more pressing at this point."
"So why didn't we tell them about Orsure?" Elland asked as their carriage bumped its way back toward Keep Venture. The three of them had taken a carriage of their own, leaving the other four to follow in the other vehicle. Vin shrugged. Orsure sat on the seat across from her and Elland, quietly watching the conversation.
"I'll tell them eventually," Vin said. "A busy city square didn't seem the right place for the revelation."
Elland smiled.
"Keeping secrets is a hard habit to break, eh?"
Vin flushed.
"I'm not keeping him secret, I'm just..."
She trailed off, looking down.
"Don't feel bad, Vin," Elland said. "You've lived a long time on your own, without anyone to trust. Nobody expects you to change overnight."
"It hasn't been one night, Elland," she said. "It's been 2 years."
Elland laid a hand on her knee.
"You're getting better. The others talk about how much you've changed."
Vin nodded.
"Another man would be afraid that I'm keeping secrets from him, too. Elland just tries to make me feel less guilty."
He was a better man than she deserved.
"Kondra," Elland said. "Vin says you do well at keeping up with her."
"Yes, your majesty," Orsure said. "These bones, though distasteful, are well equipped for tracking and quick movement."
"And if she gets hurt," Elland said, "will you be able to pull her to safety?"
"Not with any speed, your majesty. I will, however, be able to go for aid. These bones have many limitations, but I will do my best to fulfill the contract."
Elland must have caught Vin's raised eyebrow, for he chuckled.
"He'll do as he says, Vin." "The contract is everything, mistress," Orsure said. "It demands more than simple service.
It requires diligence and devotion. It is the Khandra. By serving it, we serve our people.
Vin shrugged. The group fell silent, Elend pulling a book from his pocket, Vin leaning against him. Orsure lay down, filling the entire seat opposite the humans. Eventually, the carriage rolled into the Venture courtyard, and Vin found herself looking forward to a warm bath. As they were climbing from the carriage, however, a guard rushed up to Elend. Tin allowed Vin to hear what the man said, even though he spoke before she could close the distance.
"Your Majesty," the guard whispered. "Our messenger reached you then?"
"No," Elend said with a frown as Vin walked over. The soldier gave her a look, but continued speaking. The soldiers all knew that Vin was Elend's primary bodyguard and confidant. Still, the man looked oddly concerned when he saw her.
"We, don't want to be intrusive," the soldier said. "That's why we've kept this quiet. We were just wondering if everything is all right."
He looked at Vin as he spoke. "What is this about?" Elend asked. The guard turned back toward the king.
"The corpse in Lady Vin's room."
The corpse was actually a skeleton. One completely picked clean, without a hint of blood, or even tissue, marring its shiny white surfaces. A good number of the bones were broken, however.
"I'm sorry, mistress,"
Orsure said, speaking low enough that only she could hear.
"I assumed that you were going to dispose of these."
Vin nodded. The skeleton was, of course, the one Orsure had been using before she gave him the animal body. Finding the door unlocked, Vin's usual sign that she wanted a room cleaned, the maids had entered. Vin had stashed the bones in a basket, intending to deal with them later. Apparently the maids had decided to check and see what was in the basket and been somewhat surprised. "It's all right, Captain," Elend said to the young guard, Captain Demu, second in command of the palace guard. Despite the fact that Ham shunned uniforms, this man seemed to take great pride in keeping his own uniform very neat and smart.
"You did well by keeping this quiet," Elend said. "We knew about these bones already. They aren't a reason for concern."
Demu nodded.
"We figured it was something intentional."
He didn't look at Vin as he spoke.
"Intentional," Vin thought. "Great. I wonder what this man thinks I did."
Few Ska knew what Khandra were, and Demu wouldn't know what to make of remains like these.
"Could you dispose of them quietly for me, Captain?"
Elend asked, nodding to the bones.
"Of course, Your Majesty," the guard said.
"He probably assumes I ate the person or something," Vin thought with a sigh. "Sucked the flesh right off his bones." Which, actually, wasn't that far from the truth.
"Your Majesty," Demu said, "would you like us to dispose of the other body as well?"
Vin froze.
"Other one?"
Elend asked slowly. The guard nodded.
"When we found the skeleton, we brought in some dogs to sniff about. The dogs didn't turn up any killers, but they did find another body. Just like this one. A set of bones, completely cleaned of flesh."
Vin and Elend shared a look.
"Show us," Elend said.
Demu nodded and led them out of the room, giving a few whispered orders to one of his men. The four of them, three humans and one Khandra, traveled a short distance down the palace hallway toward a less-used section of visitors' chambers. Demu dismissed a soldier standing at a particular door, then led them inside.
"This body wasn't in a basket, Your Majesty," Demu said. "It was stuffed in a back closet. We'd probably never have found it without the dogs. They picked up the scent pretty easily, though I can't see how. These corpses are completely clean of flesh."
And there it was. Another skeleton, like the first, sitting piled beside a bureau. Elend glanced at Vin, then turned to Demu.
"Would you excuse us, Captain?"
The young guard nodded, walking from the room and closing the door.
"Well," Elend said,
turning to Orsieur.
"I do not know where this came from," the Chandra said.
"But it is another Chandra-eaten corpse," Vin said.
"Undoubtedly, mistress," Orsieur said. "The dogs found it because of the particular scent our digestive juices leave on recently excreted bones."
Elland and Vin shared a look.
"However," Orsier said, "it is probably not what you think. This man was probably killed far from here."
"What do you mean?"
"They are discarded bones, your majesty," Orsier said. "The bones a Chandra leaves behind."
"After he finds a new body," Vin finished.
"Yes, mistress," Orsier said.
Vin looked at Elland, who frowned. "How long ago?" he asked. "Maybe the bones were left a year before by my father's Chandra."
"Perhaps, your majesty," Orsier said.
But he sounded hesitant. He patted over, sniffing at the bones. Vin picked up one herself, holding it to her nose. With Tin, she easily picked out a sharp scent that reminded her of bile.
"It's very strong," she said, glancing at Orsier.
He nodded.
"These bones haven't been here long, your majesty. A few hours at most. Perhaps even less."
"Which means we have another Chandra somewhere in the palace," Elland said, looking a bit sick.
"One of my staff has been eaten and replaced." "Yes, your majesty," Orsier said. "There is no way to tell from these bones whom it could be, since these are the discards. The Chandra would have taken the new bones, eating their flesh and wearing their clothing."
Ellen nodded, standing. He met Vin's eyes, and she knew he was thinking the same thing she was. It was possible that a member of the palace staff had been replaced, which would mean a slight breach in security. There was a far more dangerous possibility, however. Chandra were incomparable actors. Orsier had imitated Lord Renew so perfectly that even people who'd known him had been fooled. Such talent could have been used for the imitation of a maid or a servant. However, if an enemy had wanted to get a spy into Ellen's closed meetings, he would need to replace a person far more important.
"It would be someone that we haven't seen during the last few hours," Vin thought, dropping the bone.
She, Elland, and Orsier had been on the wall for most of the afternoon and evening, ever since the end of the assembly meeting, but the city and palace had been in chaos since the Second Army had arrived. The messengers had had trouble finding Ham, and she still wasn't certain where Doxon was. In fact, she hadn't seen Clubs until he'd joined her and Elland on the wall just a bit before, and Spook had been the last to arrive. Vin looked down at the pile of bones, feeling a sickening sense of unease. There was a very good chance that someone in their core team, a member of Kelsier's former band, was now an imposter. The end of part one. Part two. Ghosts in the Mist.
It wasn't until years later that I became convinced that Elendi was the Hero of Ages. Hero of Ages. The one called Rabzin in Hlenium. The Anamneser. Savior.
12. A fortress sat in the misty murk of evening. It rested at the bottom of a large depression in the land. The steep-sided, crater-like valley was so wide that even in daylight, Sazed would barely have been able to see the other side. In the oncoming darkness, obscured by mist, the far edge of the massive hole was only a deep shadow. Sazed knew very little about tactics and strategy. Though his metal mines held dozens of books on the subjects, he had forgotten their contents in order to create the stored records. The little he did know told him that this fortress, the Conventicle of Saren, was not very defensible. It relinquished the high ground, and the crater's sides would provide an excellent location for siege engines to pelt rocks down at the walls. This fortress, however, had not been built to defend against enemy soldiers.
It had been built to provide solitude. The crater made it difficult to find, for a slight rise in the land around the crater's lip made it practically invisible until one drew near. No roads or paths marked the way, and travelers would have great trouble getting down the sheer sides. The Inquisitors did not want visitors.
"Well?" Marsh asked.
He and Sazed stood on the crater's northern lip before a drop of several hundred feet. Sazed tapped his vision tin mind, drawing forth some of the eyesight he had stored within it. The edges of his vision fuzzed, but things directly in front of him seemed to grow much closer. He tapped a little more sight, ignoring the nausea that came from compounding so much vision. The increased eyesight let him study the conventicle, as if he stood before it. He could see each notch in the dark stone walls, flat, broad, imposing. He could discern each bit of rust on the large steel plates that hung bolted into outside stones of the wall. He could see each lichen-encrusted corner and ash-stained ledge. There were no windows.
"I do not know," Sazed said slowly, releasing his vision tin mind. "It is not easy to say whether or not the fortress is inhabited. There is no motion, nor is there light. But perhaps the Inquisitors are just hiding in sight."
"No," Marsh said, his stiff voice uncomfortably loud in the evening air. "They are gone."
"Why would they leave? This is a place of great strength, I think. Poor defense against an army, but a great defense against the chaos of the times."
Marsh shook his head.
"They are gone."
"How are you so certain?"
"I do not know."
"Where did they go, then?"
Marsh looked at him, then turned and glanced over his shoulder.
"North."
"Toward Luthadel?"
Sazed asked, frowning.
"Among other things," Marsh said. "Come. I do not know if they will return, but we should exploit this opportunity."
Sazed nodded. This was why they had come, after all. Still, a part of him hesitated. He was a man of books and genteel service. Traveling the countryside to visit villages was enough removed from his experience to be discomforting. Infiltrating the Inquisitor stronghold. Marsh obviously didn't care about his companion's inner struggles. The Inquisitor turned and began to walk along the rim of the crater. Sazed threw his pack over his shoulder, then followed. They eventually arrived at a cage-like contraption, obviously meant to be lowered down to the bottom by ropes and pulleys. The cage sat locked in place at the top ledge, and Marsh stopped at its side but did not enter.
"What?"
Sazed asked.
"The pulley system," Marsh said. "The cage is meant to be lowered by men holding it from below."
Sazed nodded, realizing this was true. Marsh stepped forward and threw a lever. The cage fell. Ropes began to smoke, and pulleys squealed as the massive cage plummeted toward the chasm floor. A muted crash echoed against the rocks.
"If there is anyone down there," Sazed thought, "they now know we are here."
Marsh turned toward him, the heads of his eye spikes glistening slightly in the failing sunlight.
"Follow however you wish," he said.
Then he tied off the counter rope and began to climb down the ropes. Sazed stepped up to the platform's edge, watching Marsh shimmy down the dangling rope into the shadowed, misty abyss. Then Sazed knelt and opened his pack. He unhooked the large metal bracers around his upper and lower arms, his core copper mines. They contained the memories of a keeper, the stored knowledge of centuries past. He reverently placed them to the side, then pulled a pair of much smaller bracelets, one iron, one pewter, from the pack. Metal mines for a warrior. Did Marsh understand how unskilled Sazed was in this area? Amazing strength did not a warrior make. Regardless, Sazed snapped the two bracelets around his ankles. Next, he pulled out two rings, tin and copper.
These he slipped on his fingers. He closed the pack and threw it over his shoulder, then picked up his core copper mines. He carefully located a good hiding place, a secluded hollow between two boulders, and slid them inside. Whatever happened below, he didn't want to risk them being taken and destroyed by the Inquisitors. In order to fill a copper mine with memories, Sazed had listened to another keeper recite his entire collection of histories, facts, and stories. Sazed had memorized each sentence, then shoved those memories into the copper mine for later retrieval. Sazed remembered very little of the actual experience, but he could draw forth any of the books or essays he wished, placing them back into his mind, gaining the ability to recollect them as crisply as when he'd first memorized them. He just had to have the bracers on. Being without his copper mines made him anxious. He shook his head, walking back over to the platform. Marsh was moving very quickly down toward the chasm floor. Like all Inquisitors, he had the powers of a Mistborn. Though how he had gotten those powers, and how he managed to live despite the spikes that had been driven directly through his brain, was a mystery. Marsh had never answered Sazed's questions on the subject. Sazed called down, drawing Marsh's attention, then held up his pack and dropped it. Marsh reached out, and the pack lurched, pulled by its metals into Marsh's hand. The Inquisitor threw it over his shoulder before continuing his descent. Sazed nodded thankfully, then stepped off the platform. As he began to fall, he mentally reached into his iron mind, searching for the power he had stored therein. Filling a metal mind always had a cost. In order to store up sight, Sazed had been forced to spend weeks with poor eyesight. During that time, he had worn a tin bracelet, stowing away the excess sight for later use. Iron was a bit different from the others. It didn't store up sight, strength, endurance, or even memories. It stored up something completely different. Weight. This day, Sazed didn't tap the power stored inside the iron mind. That would have made him more heavy. Instead, he began to fill the iron mind, letting it suck away his weight. He felt a familiar sense of lightness, a sense that his own body wasn't pressing upon itself as forcefully. His fall slowed. The Terrace philosophers had much to say on using an iron mind. They explained that the power didn't actually change a person's bulk or size. It just somehow changed the way that the ground pulled against them. Sazed's fall didn't slow because of his decrease in weight. It slowed because he suddenly had a relatively large amount of surface exposed to the wind of his fall, and a lighter body to go along with it. Regardless of the scientific reasons, Sazed didn't fall as quickly. The thin metal bracelets on his legs were the heaviest things on his body, and they kept him pointed feet downward. He held out his arms and bent his body slightly, letting the wind push against him. His descent was not terribly slow, not like that of a leaf or a feather. However, he didn't plummet either. Instead, he fell in a controlled, almost leisurely manner. Clothing flapping, arms outspread, he passed Marsh, who watched with a curious expression. As he approached the ground, Sazed tapped his pewter mind, drawing forth a tiny bit of strength to prepare. He hit the ground, but because his body was so light, there was very little shock. He barely even needed to bend his knees to absorb the force of impact. He stopped filling the iron mind, released his pewter, and waited quietly for Marsh. Beside him, the carrying cage lay in shambles. Sazed noticed several broken iron shackles with discomfort. Apparently some of those who had visited the conventicle had not come by choice. By the time Marsh neared the bottom, the mists were thick in the air. Sazed had lived with them all of his life, and had never before felt uncomfortable in them. Yet now he half expected the mists to begin choking him. To kill him, as they seemed to have done to old Jed, the unfortunate farmer whose death Sazed had investigated. Marsh dropped the last 10 feet or so, landing with an Allomancer's increased agility. Even after spending so much time with Mistborn, Sazed was impressed with Allomancy's gifts.
Of course, he'd never been jealous of them. Not really.
True, Alamancy was better in a fight, but it could not expand the mind, giving one access to the dreams, hopes, and beliefs of 1,000 years of culture. It could not give the knowledge to treat a wound, or help teach a poor village to use modern fertilization techniques. The metal mines of Ferrochemy weren't flamboyant, but they had a far more lasting value to society. Besides, Sazed knew a few tricks about Ferrochemy that were bound to surprise even the most prepared warrior. Marsh handed in the pack.
Come.
Sazed nodded, shouldering the pack and following the Inquisitor across the rocky ground. Walking next to Marsh was odd, for Sazed wasn't accustomed to being around people who were as tall as he was. Terracemen were tall by nature, and Sazed even more so. His arms and legs were a bit too long for his body, a medical condition brought on by his having been castrated as a very young boy. Though the Lord Ruler was dead, Terrace culture would long feel the effects of his stewardship and breeding programs, the methods by which he had tried to breed ferrochemical powers out of the Terrace people. The conventicle of Saren loomed in the darkness, looking even more ominous now that Sazed stood within the crater. Marsh strode right up to the front doors, and Sazed followed behind. He wasn't afraid, not really. Fear had never been a strong motivator in Sazed's life. However, he did worry. There were so few keepers left. If he died, that was one fewer person who could travel, restoring lost truths and teaching the people.
Not that I'm doing such at the moment, anyway.
Marsh regarded the massive steel doors. Then he threw his weight against one, obviously burning pewter to enhance his strength. Sazed joined him, pushing hard. The door did not budge. Regretting the expenditure of power, Sazed reached into his pewter mind and tapped strength. He used far more than he had when landing, and his muscles immediately increased in size. Unlike Alamancy, Ferrochemy often had direct effects on a person's body. Beneath his robes, Sazed gained the bulk and build of a lifetime warrior, easily becoming twice as strong as he had been a moment earlier. With their combined effort, the two of them managed to push the door open. It did not creak. It slid slowly but evenly inward, exposing a long, dark hallway. Sazed released his pewter mind, reverting to his normal self. Marsh strode into the conventicle, his feet kicking up the mist that had begun to pour through the open doorway.
Marsh? Sazed asked.
The Inquisitor turned.
I won't be able to see inside there.
You're Ferrochemy.
Sazed shook his head.
It can let me see better in darkness, but only if there's some light to begin with. In addition, tapping that much sight would drain my tin mind in a matter of minutes. I'll need a lantern.
Marsh paused, then nodded. He turned into the darkness, quickly disappearing from Sazed's view.
So, Sazed thought, Inquisitors don't need light to see.
It was to be expected. The spikes filled Marsh's entire sockets, completely destroying the eyeballs. Whatever strange power allowed Inquisitors to see, it apparently worked just as well in pure darkness as it did in daylight. Marsh returned a few moments later, carrying a lamp. From the chains Sazed had seen on the descent cage, Sazed suspected that the Inquisitors had kept a sizable group of slaves and servants to attend their needs. If that was the case, where had the people gone? Had they fled? Sazed lit the lamp with a flint from his pack. The lamp's ghostly light illuminated a stark, daunting hallway. He stepped into the conventicle, holding the lamp high, and began to fill the small copper ring on his finger, the process transforming it into a copper mind.
Large rooms, he whispered, without adornment.
He didn't really need to say the words, but he'd found that speaking helped him form distinct memories. He could then place them into the copper mind.
The Inquisitors obviously had a fondness for steel, he continued. This is not surprising, considering that their religion was often referred to as the Steel Ministry. The walls are hung with massive steel plates, which bear no rust, unlike the ones outside. Many of those here are not completely smooth, but instead crafted with some interesting patterns etched, almost buffed, into their surfaces.
Marsh frowned, turning toward him.
What are you doing?
Sazed held up his right hand, showing the copper ring.
I must make an account of this visit. I will need to repeat this experience back to other keepers when the opportunity presents itself. There is much to be learned from this place, I think.
Marsh turned away.
You should not care about the Inquisitors. They are not worthy of your record.
It isn't a matter of worthiness, Marsh, Sazed said, holding up his lamp to study a square pillar. Knowledge of all religions is valuable. I must make certain these things persist.
Sazed regarded the pillar for a moment, then closed his eyes and formed an image of it inside his head, which he then added to the copper mind. Visual memories, however, were less useful than spoken words. Visualizations faded very quickly once taken out of a copper mind, suffering from the mind's distortion. Plus, they could not be passed to other keepers. Marsh didn't respond to Sazed's comment about religion. He just turned and walked deeper into the building. Sazed followed at a slower pace, speaking to himself, recording the words in his copper mind. It was an interesting experience. As soon as he spoke, he felt the thoughts sucked from his mind, leaving behind a blank hollowness. He had difficulty remembering the specifics of what he had just been saying. However, once he was done filling his copper mind, he would be able to tap those memories later and know them with crisp clarity.
The room is tall, he said. There are a few pillars, and they are also wrapped in steel. They are blocky and square, rather than round. I get a sense that this place was created by a people who cared little for subtlety. They ignored small details in favor of broad lines and full geometries. As we move beyond the main entryway, this architectural theme continues. There are no paintings on the walls, nor are there wooden adornments or tile floors. Instead, there are only the long, broad hallways with their harsh lines and reflective surfaces. The floor is constructed of steel squares, each a few feet across. They are cold to the touch. It is strange not to see the tapestries, stained glass windows, and sculpted stones that are so common in Luthadel's architecture. There are no spires or vaultings here. Just squares and rectangles. Lines. So many lines. Nothing here is soft. No carpet, no rugs, no windows. It is a place for people who see the world differently from ordinary men. Marsh walked straight down this massive hallway, as if oblivious to its decor. I will follow him, then come back to record more later. He seems to be following something, I cannot sense. Perhaps it is...
Sazed trailed off as he stepped around a bend and saw Marsh standing in the doorway of a large chamber. The lamplight flickered unevenly as Sazed's arm quivered. Marsh had found the servants. They had been dead long enough that Sazed hadn't noticed the scent until he had come close. Perhaps that was what Marsh had been following. The senses of a man burning tin could be quite acute. The Inquisitors had done their work thoroughly. These were the remnants of a slaughter. The room was large but had only one exit, and the bodies were piled high near the back, killed by what looked like harsh sword or axe strokes. The servants had huddled up against the back wall as they died. Sazed turned away. Marsh, however, remained in the doorway.
There is a bad air about this place, he finally said.
You have only just noticed that? Sazed asked.
Marsh turned, glancing at him, demanding his gaze.
We should not spend much time here. There are stairs at the end of the hallway behind us. I will go up. That is where the Inquisitor's quarters will be. If the information I seek is here, I will find it there. You may stay or you may descend. However, do not follow me.
Sazed frowned.
Why?
I must be alone here. I cannot explain it. I do not care if you witness Inquisitor atrocities. I just do not wish to be with you when you do.
Sazed lowered his lamp, turning its light away from the horrific scene.
Very well.
Marsh turned, brushing past Sazed and disappearing into the dark hallway. And Sazed was alone. He tried not to think about that very much. He returned to the main hallway, describing the slaughter to his copper mind before giving a more detailed explanation of the architecture and the art, if indeed that was what the different patterns on the wall plates could be called. As he worked, his voice echoing quietly against the rigid architecture, his lamp a weak drop of light reflected in steel, his eyes were drawn toward the back of the hallway. There was a pool of darkness there, a stairwell leading down. Even as he turned back to his description of one of the wall mounts, he knew that he would eventually find himself walking toward that darkness. It was the same as ever. The curiosity, the need to understand the unknown. This sense had driven him as a keeper, had led him to Kelsier's company. His search for truths could never be completed, but neither could it be ignored. So he eventually turned and approached the stairwell, his own whispering voice his only companion.